For me, thrillers are stories that use tension as the major driver. And that's different from mystery, where mystery is being driven by a question. With the thriller, it's frequently, you know the answer, you know who the bad guy is. It's that tension of how our storyline is going to interact. Where is the danger going to come from?
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to episode 29 of SFF Addicts, a bi-weekly panel podcast about science fiction and fantasy literature, as well as the occasional jaunt into the wider SFF industry. I'm your host, Adrian M. Gibson, and this week we're chasing thrills as I discuss modern sci-fi thrillers with authors Mary Robinette Kowal, Sylvain Novel, Nia N. E. Davenport, James Kennedy, and Jane Gilmartin. Thriller is one of those genres I've always enjoyed, but never classified or thought about consciously as thriller. But since starting this podcast, I've come to realize how many of my favorite stories are indeed thrillers, and even better when a thriller is combined with science fiction. 'Tis a thing of beauty when two genres meld so perfectly, and my guest this week taught me a lot about everything from structure and expectations to tension and pacing. If you have any feedback about this episode, questions, comments, counters, and the like, send me an email at sffaddictspod@gmail.com or hit me up on Twitter at sffaddictspod or at Adrian M. Gibson. All right, now on to the panel. Here we go. All right. Welcome, everybody, to episode 29 of SFF Addicts. And I'm very, very excited for today's topic, where we will be amping up the suspense by discussing modern sci-fi thrillers. I love a good thriller, something with a fast pace, high stakes tension and action and that kind of thing, which is why I'm so thrilled to be joined by this amazing panel of authors, all of whom are making first appearances on the podcast. And to kick things off, we have Mary Robinette Kowal, who is the award-winning author of the Lady Astronaut series, the Glamorist History series, and more. She also co-hosts the podcast Writing Excuses, which is one of the reasons I actually started this podcast, so thank you, and was the president of the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America from 2019 to 2021. And her latest book is The Spare Man, which just released through Tor Books. We're recording this in the past, but it's coming out in the future, so the book will be out by that point. But happy to have you here, Mary Robinette. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And my next guest is Sylvain Novel. He's a fellow Canadian and the author of the Themis Files series, as well as the Take Them to the Stars series, of which the latest book is Until the Last of Me, which just came out last March through Tor.com. So it's great to have you on the podcast, Sylvain. How's it going?
Thank you. It's an honor to be in such great company.
Yeah, definitely. And also joining us is Nia N. E. Davenport, author of The Blood Trials, book one in the Blood Gift Duology, and book two is coming out next spring, which I'm very excited about. So welcome to the show, Nia. How are you?
Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure. And next up is Jane Gilmartin. She's the author of The Mirror Man, her debut novel, and she's also been a news reporter and editor, as well as a rock music journalist, which I was also a music journalist in university, so, you know. Bringing things first full circle, but anyways, it's great to have you here on the panel. Jane, how are you?
Good. Thank you very much. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, me too. And finally, James Kennedy. He's the author of Dare to Know and The Order of Odd Fish, as well as the founder of the 92nd Newbury Film Festival. Thanks for pimping your books. I appreciate that. Glad you could join us, James. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really honored to be on this panel.
I'm very, very excited to have you all here. Thank you all so much. But to get the discussion going, just to kick things off, I would like each of you to share what makes a given story thrilling for you. And then to build on top of that, how would you even define a thriller? So Mary Robinette, we'll kick it off with you.
Yeah. So for me, thrillers are stories that use tension as the major driver. And that's different from mystery, where mystery is being driven by a question. with the thriller, it's frequently, you know, the answer, you know, who the bad guy is. It's that tension of how are storylines going to interact? Where is the danger going to come from? So for me, thrillers are primarily defined by continuously escalating tension.
Yeah, I like that. And we're definitely going to get into that structural stuff a little bit later on. But Jane, do you want to share your take as well?
In my mind, I tend to differentiate between science fiction as a genre and a science fiction thriller. And for me, what that means can be boiled down to one word, which I think is plausibility. In typical, you know, science fiction, you're off on whatever, different planets, or dealing with time travel or alien species, whatever. And so you're telling a story through that world, a strange world, and the reader experiences like, well, yeah, I can believe that, but it's not really going to happen. But when you do a thriller, I think it has to be based on something plausible that could happen. And I think just that ramps up the tension for the reader anyway, because you're dealing with something scientific or technological that could almost happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly why Jurassic Park worked so well, because it's so plausible.
Yeah.
This is interesting, though, because Nia, her debut novel is secondary world, it's a far future sort of, you know, distant planets with blood magic type magic system and stuff like that. But at the same time, you do manage to bring in these thriller elements. I'm curious, Nia, what's your take in terms of what makes a story thrilling for you, but also to kind of speak on what Jane has been talking about?
I would make the disclaimer, I did not intentionally do it when I first drafted it. It is something that I pulled out of, you know, subsequent editing. It was like, this actually plays really well with the sci-fi aspect. And for me, it's about the mood that's being created. And so when I read thrillers, I'm normally drawn to them because they elicit like fear and like suspense and anticipation and twistiness that some of the twists I can see coming. Some of them I'm like, oh my God, I did not predict that. But the fun is in trying to predict, I think, the route that it's going to take, and then being surprised, or even being like, ha ha, I knew it. And so that's definitely what I was looking to grasp when I tried to blend thriller aspects into the blood trials.
That's very cool. And I love how you bring up that surprise element, because not only is there a surprise for the reader, but there is also a surprise for the writer when they have that holy shit moment where it's like, this story just took a turn and I'm no idea it was going to go there. But that makes the story so much more exciting, because if there's tension and suspense in the writing process, just as much as in the reading process, I think that's beautiful. Beautiful. And Sylvain, what about you?
I don't know. To me, a good thriller is something that sort of creates this weird contradiction where I'm terrified bad things are going to happen, like things I'm actually going to profoundly dislike, and yet I want to keep reading until they do eventually happen. Other than that, I guess I agree with everything everyone said before. But yeah, there's something about not sort of like expecting bad things to happen, not wanting them to happen, and yet just being sort of drawn into reading more until eventually the thing you didn't want to happen sort of jumps at you.
Yeah, it's like the rope that you just slowly tighten around the reader as you pull them along and be like, I'm just enticing you with every page. And speaking of weird stuff that drags you through a narrative, James, give me your take as well.
So I think there's a difference between things that are thrilling and thrillers. I think I might have a more restrictive definition of a thriller. Like I think, you know, like, I don't think Star Wars is a thriller, but it's thrilling, right? I think a thriller is, in a way, it has a similar structure to a comedy, that it's usually about some hero who creates their own problem by transgressing society's norms. And then there's some consequences. So it's like discontent, transgression, consequences, and then victory or defeat. So it's like, Double Indemnity is a thriller. A Rear Window is a thriller. Strangers on a Train is a thriller. And they all start with this willful transgression. Mm. Like Blue Velvet is a thriller. Fatal Attraction is a thriller. I think a lot of things could be thrilling, but I think a classical thriller has this kind of element of transgression to it.
Yeah,
I like that. Can I jump on that? Because I love that. I love the willful transgression. I'm like, that's so beautifully defined. For me, science fiction and I think there are two types of genres. There's a structure-driven genre and there's an aesthetic-driven genre. And thriller to me is a structure-driven genre. There are certain beats that you have to hit. The ones that Naya was talking about. Sorry, Naya or Nia? I was...
Yeah.
Okay.
My brain was like, no, that was the wrong vowel. What Nia was talking about, and it's a place where I actually do differ from Jane, and that like science fiction can happen anywhere, but it's about the aesthetic of it. Science fiction as a whole doesn't have a genre; it can happen anywhere, and that's part of why it's so easy to map it on to a structure-driven genre like a thriller. And I think what you're talking about with that willful transgression is just a brilliant, brilliant breakdown. Like that's
it's not mine. It's my friend, Matt Bird. He thought that up. So let me give credit to him.
Matt Bird, you are brilliant. Thank you for that.
And he also had a codicil to that, which is that a thriller's structure is similar to a comedy. A comedy usually starts with some transgression, and for the first half, somebody's kind of wearing a mask of like trying to be something that they're not, and then at the midpoint, they have to do it the honest way. And I think a thriller is all like that. For the first half, they're kind of enjoying that transgression, and for the second half, they're kind of getting punished for the transgression.
There's a thing that Howard Taylor, I'm not sure where he got it from, but he talks about an element of comedy is that it is a benign violation. And you just made me realize, oh, the difference is in a thriller, that violation is not benign.
Yeah.
But
Blue Velvet is not a benign violation.
not compared
to like a Matthew McConaughey comedy or something like
right.
that. Yeah. It's exactly as you explain it. It's like, oh yeah, he gets to that turning point. He has to do things honestly.
Yeah.
I love that breakdown. And you know, it's so cool because, you know, because Mary Robinette, you brought up this point of the structural integrity of the thriller genre makes it so good to map science fiction over top of that. I think that's a really awesome point because it's like, yeah, you do have the secondary world building or the, you know, our world, but in a different time or an alternate history or what have you. But that structure gives it such a solid enough foundation that the believability that Jane mentioned is always possible. It's not necessarily, I don't think, the world that needs to have that structural integrity as opposed to the actual genre itself, which I think is why those two meld together so brilliantly. But does anyone want to get in on this sort of, you know, melding of thriller with science fiction, but also why you felt it was a compelling enough reason for you to write your books in that mashup?
I have no idea what I'm doing. I never never occurred to me that I was writing a science fiction thriller, not once.
Yeah.
I grew up in Quebec City. I didn't speak English, so I read in French, mostly stuff I could buy for cheap on the for sale table, you know, back of the store. So you'd get, I don't know, like John Le Carré or Robert Ludlum or Michael Crichton or Anne Rice they're all translated by the same people. So I guess it sort of didn't help, but it never sort of occurred to me back then anyway, that Michael Crichton was different than John Le Carré. It was just a bunch of people doing things that weren't happening for real. And they had a similar voice. The translations in French are sort of share the same voice, no matter who you read. So boxers came much later when I realized, you know, people came over and said, well, your bookshelves are weird because you have a bunch of stuff from different genres mixed in together. I'm like, oh, so
don't judge me. That's fascinating though. It's like, I'd never thought about that, you know? But at the same time, it's like living here in Ecuador, I see how they handle things like translations. I go to the bookstore and the way that they compile different genres together is really strange from my perception of growing up in Canada. But I'd never thought about the fact that beyond just translation and genre classification, the actual translation itself you know, if it's translated by very similar people all the time, tonally, it's like things are just going to sound similar because it's like the translator's voice becomes an authorial voice to a degree, you know?
Oh, yeah, they're definitely, they become part of the message and you kind of sort of learn to live with it. But I don't know, from my perspective, you know, one had dinosaurs, the other had spies, but they were more or less the same thing.
Yeah. Spies, dinosaurs, give or take.
Yeah.
But I mean, I mean, you're not wrong, like, because they are both thrillers. And even though the trapping of them is the aesthetic, or the setting of them is so different, that they are dealing with many of the same structural beats.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. Huh.
It's true, though, that that For Sale table tends to attract thrillers more than anything. Yeah.
They're the quickest to go to mass market paperback, I guess.
Yeah.
Jane, what about you? You know, you brought up that point earlier about, you know, science fiction and thriller and that sort of distinction between the two. But, you know, after everything everyone said, you know, what was your approach when you wrote The Mirror Man? And how did you kind of take it in how do you think about it in the context of what we've been discussing already?
Just like Sylvain, I didn't set out to write a science fiction thriller at all. And I didn't really know that I had written one at first. It really was a, you know, supposed to just be a story about what might happen if a guy could watch his life being lived on a TV screen, and what would that do to the guy? But I think, you know, afterward, in the revisions, it really did become a thriller. And I was really kind of getting that sense that it was going to be a thriller. And I think one of the things that sci-fi lends itself to a thriller concept so well is that science itself could be the bad guy. I mean, technology or something getting in the wrong hands of someone, or, you know, the evil mad scientist kind of trope, or, you know, messing with some sort of science that we shouldn't be, you know, playing God or whatever. There are so many different angles, and there's so many kind of different built-in villains, nemesis, you know, evil doing. So I think that sci-fi really can lend itself to be a thriller.
Mm-hmm. And you're also, in The Mirror Man in particular, you were bringing in some very, what I feel are sort of extensions of cyberpunk as well, with the big evil corporation. And like you said, there, on one hand, there's access to technology, but on another hand, there's the handling of technology and the way a corporation would handle this technology and the moral implications of that versus the sort of outsider perspective and how they perceive this.
Right. It's who's in charge.
This digression of morality and everything like that, I think, is really cool. And you brought up a point there that, you know, you, Sylvain, neither of you were really thinking that you were writing thrillers in the writing process. Nia, you brought up that as well. Do you think it's just sort of this unconscious osmosis from the types of stories that you enjoyed reading or the types of movies that you enjoyed watching that had these very structural thriller elements to them? And that just kind of naturally came through in terms of the story that you had written and what you were sort of needing in terms of the characters and the pacing and that kind of stuff.
Nia, yeah, I think there's something to that. We are influenced by what? By the entertainment you gravitate towards. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nia, do you want to get on this?
No, I definitely think so. I think from as long as I can remember, I kind of cut my teeth on urban fantasy and paranormal romance kind of side by side. And Mary was saying that, like, science fiction, fantasy is very like aesthetic driven, whereas thriller is very like structural driven. And I think a lot of the urban fantasies that I've read for so many years, they have these huge, beautiful aesthetic like magics and like worlds. And then they use either thriller and or mystery elements to kind of like advance us through these amazing set pieces. And it's really cool magic. So I think I definitely just kind of internalized and soaked all of that up when I was trying to write The Blood Trials. I didn't mean to write a sci-fi thriller. I meant to write a really cool magical world. And I was like, okay, I have all this cool magic and all of these like political clashes, but what's the driving, you know, factor that's getting my character and my plot from A to B? Mm-hmm. And then just kind of like, I internalized, oh, there, like, there needs to be a body. And we need to be figuring out who dropped the body.
Yeah, but it's cool because you started off your book with A, somebody kicking somebody else's ass, and then B, a dead body. So it's kind of like you took elements from thriller and from mystery and combine those together. So that was really cool. Cause it's like Mary Robinette, you said earlier, it's like, there's, you know, the question that drives a mystery, but there's the suspense that drives a thriller. So it's like, you can even get deeper than just adding thriller elements. You can add a dead body and just kind of up the ante of like, oh shit, who done it? But also this is really suspenseful.
James, maybe the reason, maybe the reason that science fiction makes for, is fertile for thrillers is because it gives you new ways to transgress. Like going back to my transgression point, like in Jurassic Park, the transgression is, you know, cloning the dinosaurs. Like it's like a Blake Crouch novel, like Recursion, like the transgression is going back and changing your own past, you know, or with the transgression with Mirror Man of like going, getting to watch, you know, a clone of you do your own life. So these are all transgressions, but sci-fi can give us new transgressions that nobody ever thought of before.
Mm.
Interesting.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. And that actually ties really nicely into this next topic, which is, you know, what I mentioned Nia's story starts off with somebody getting their ass kicked and then a dead body. I think an inciting incident is very important in establishing sort of what a thriller is going to be, what this particular thriller is going to be. Even if you have a science fictional set sort of dressing over top of it, there needs to be an inciting incident that gives you the incentive to invest in this world, invest in these characters. You know, James, your book Dare to Know, the inciting incident is like, do you want to know when you die? And that for me is very, very enticing.
Well, I guess in this case, the transgression is the inciting incident. The person like seriously contemplating or actually doing the transgression.
Yeah, exactly. Does anyone want to sort of build on this idea of how I would like to combine it with transgression, because I really like this concept, James. The transgression and or the inciting incident, how those are the way for you to A, establish your world and your characters, but also to establish reader expectations about what they can expect from this kind of story.
Like I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about my own, which I did deliberately write as a thriller, but I didn't write thinking about, you know, this willful transgression. And I'm like, I guess my character's willful transgression is that she's a woman in the 1950s.
And the unwillful transgression is that a meteorite strikes Earth.
Well, but Calculating Stars isn't a thriller.
It does have like very thriller elements to it.
It does. There are moments where it has thriller elements, but it's structurally, it's not a thriller. Mm. Relentless Moon is unquestionably a thriller.
Yes.
And very deliberately so. But you know, in Calculating Stars, the meteor striking the Earth is definitely not a willful transgression. That she didn't want that to happen. and I think in Relentless Moon, probably the willful transgression is that I have a character as a woman in the 1950s who is ambitious, and that is, you know, that is, she wants to be a politician's wife. She wants to be an astronaut. She wants to be not just an astronaut, but she wants to be important. She wants to be center stage. But having said that, I think one of the other elements that I think turns up in pretty much everything that I can think of as a thriller, not everything, but many things, because Jurassic Park, I can't think of this, but is politics. That there's some political or espionage thing that is happening. That is a frequent element where there is someone who is trying to get information out of someone else. And the process of trying to get that information causes to hush up information causes things to get out of hand and escalate, you know, this escalation of that. So I'm sitting here going, what, you know, within the framework that we've proposed of the willful transgression, it's like, where can I point to the inciting incident there and in my own work? And I might have to reread my book. Like, so, I can think of inciting incidents where things kick off, but the willful transgression aspect of it is the interesting one.
Mm-hmm. I think once you start talking about politics, you start getting into the conspiracy stories, which usually is like there's an injustice, then there's an overconfident investigative crusade, then there's betrayals, and there's a revelation. So that's like Chinatown, Manchurian Candidate, the LA Confidential, All the President's Men. And so you've got a lot of... there's like big shadowy unaccountable forces, right? That like they've been behind it all along, or the thing that the hero did causes those things to get activated and come after him. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that's like a brother genre to thriller would be conspiracy. I guess you get conspiracy thrillers, but I think they're two separate. You can have one or the other, but you can have them both as well.
Well, yeah. On that note, it's like Sylvain Sleeping Giants in particular is very much like conspiracies and these sort of the obfuscating of reality to cover up the fact that there are these, you know, remnants of alien, sort of like robotic aliens. Where was it in terms of that process where you're thinking like on this topic of inciting incident and you know, willful transgression, where do you feel that when you were writing Sleeping Giants, something clicked in your head and you thought like, okay, this is the kind of thing that's, boom, going to launch this story into the reader's imagination and pull them along and get them invested in what's going on?
Well, the genesis of the book is sort of what set the tone for everything. It's a toy story. I was going to build a toy for my kid. And he started asking a whole bunch of questions about the toy. Like, what is it? What kind of robot? Does it fly? Does it pilots and whatnot? So I needed a story for it, and I thought I was going to write a kid's story originally, and then I thought, well, what if it happened in real life, and how do we tell a giant robot story in the most believable way we can? So that was sort of how everything got started. Everything after that is just questions on how to best do that. So I chose dialogue because I think it's the most objective way of telling a story. I chose documents because I thought, well, if it happened in real life, you know, no one would know. It'd be top secret, but it'd be a paper trace somewhere. And what if I write the paper trace? And so I also like the idea that the book itself sort of exists in the story that's inside the book, the physical thing. But I keep thinking, you know, while everyone else was talking, I was trying to think like, what's the transgression? Where's the transgression? And I think in this book, and I guess most of the things that I wrote, the transgression always comes from curiosity. Like, you just keep going after things you should have just let lie. Rose falls into that hand, but she could just forget about it and live her life, but she becomes obsessed by it, and it sort of shapes her life, and after that they you know, eventually they realize they're looking for something that spells bad news for everyone, but they can't stop doing it because it's just there.
Yeah, I love that like relentless obsession. And that's also something like Neon Jane that plays into each of your books as well. It's like, you know, in the Blood Trials, the relentless obsession with trying to figure out who killed her grandfather, you know, and in the Mirror Man, it's like the relentless obsession of like what watching your clone does to you on like a psychological level, and then trying to figure out like how do I get back into my my own life? Because I fucking hate watching this all from a distance. And it's just like the obsession that comes with like what's going on in this corporation, what's going on in my family that I have no access to and all this kind of stuff, I think is really cool. And, you know, this plays perfectly into why pacing and tension and things like action are so integral to the thriller genre. And I think because of all these elements that each of you have added into your books from a science fictional lens, that gives you even more flexibility to provide, James, as you mentioned earlier, like provide, you know, pacing cues and tension and that kind of stuff in a way that is just believable enough, but also kind of like otherworldly to the sense that you're intrigued by what's going on from like a world building or character level. You're like, oh shit, that's really cool. That's really cool. But then it also plays with the structure to thrust you even further and kind of grab your attention again and again and again. Jane, do you want to play off of this idea of like pacing, intention, action, those kind of things, and how that plays into your stories?
With the Mirror Man, it was pacing and tension and action were hard because almost the entire story takes place in a single room. So it's a very small world. But the way that I looked at it and the way that I wrote it was sort of trying to imagine the reader kind of looking over my character's shoulder, kind of trapped in the room with him, unable to escape, unable to look away. And I think, so the tension in mine, I think, at least I tried, was to get it a little bit more of a psychological tension. The reader just knew almost exactly what he knew. And so there was kind of this, hopefully this feeling of finding everything out at the same time as the character, but the reader is also finding out about the character as he's finding out about him, more about himself. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that really pertains to the question, but it was, for me, the pacing and the tension was difficult to.
Well, if I can jump in, that's why the book hits so hard. Well, The Mirror Man is amazing because it's hyper claustrophobic. Exactly. You are stuck in that room with that guy and he's forced to watch himself discovering things about himself that he doesn't like, and it sort of hits so close to home. Like it slowly and like gradually becomes more and more and more uncomfortable for everyone, for him, but for you too, because you can't escape and you have to watch yourself while he's watching himself. And the claustrophobia is a big part of it, because you can't escape it, you can't leave.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how so many types of thriller transgressions are the transgression of voyeurism. Like that would be voyeurism. Rear Window is voyeurism. Blue Velvet is voyeurism. And maybe it's because we're all voyeurs just reading the book in the first place. Mm-hmm. So it's particularly well suited for that.
I was thinking
it's a very meta thing.
Yeah.
The voyeurism of voyeurs.
Yeah, I was thinking less about voyeurism, but more that that it often begins with asking the question that you should have left alone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it's like, what is happening in that other room? You know, the rear window. What's in this briefcase? Like, don't open other people's briefcases.
Yeah, but I think that's a very cool thing, because it's like the pacing and the tension a lot of the time comes from the character's decisions. You know, it's like the character is, you know, for me, very integral to a lot of thrillers, even though sometimes some characters get a little bit of short shrift. But I think if you can find a character who is making decisions that make that act as propellant for the narrative, that is very enticing. And it's even better, you know, like in Jane and the Mirror Man, how the voyeurism of this character, this sort of meta voyeurism that's going on, adds to the complexity of the character at the same time as pushing the story along in the direction that it needs to go. So I think that's a very interesting thing too. If anyone wants to get in on this discussion of tension, but also we can kind of bring character into it as well.
So, go ahead. Go, Nia.
No. I was going to say, it's interesting you say character intention. So I did not intentionally write The Blood Trials as a thriller, but my YA that comes out next fall was intentionally written as a speculative thriller from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And it starts off with this suburban teen she's like 17-year-old me. She's stuck in a suburb. She's bored with life. She's like, you know, her willful transgression is I'm chasing, you know, a thrill. I want adventure. And so she does the rebellious thing. She gets a piercing. She goes to a rave. She does some drugs. And she's like, oh, you know, this is normal. I'll be fine. Only she wakes up completely in a different body. I always call it like if altered carbon met like Freaky Friday, right? So he wakes up like, oh shit, this is my best friend's body. And so then the rest of the plot is her trying to figure out if, you know, her supposed best friend really has like malicious intent. And if she's trying to take over her life, or if it was all just some like Freaky Friday, you know, fatalistic mix up. But it really starts with like, it may be the hardest thing I've ever had to write because it was very much like structural driven and less about like the cool, like aesthetics of like, just like these really amazing, like sci-fi fantasy, like set pieces. So I had to like, I remember going through edits and my editor being like, okay, let's focus less on the vibe and more on, you know, the structural, you know, like the tension and like the pacing and making sure the action is high throughout and making sure, you know, the character is driving, you know, the tension and the pacing and the choices that they're making is always upping the tension. Mm-hmm. So it was a really cool experience. It was a really challenging experience. But yeah, definitely it's something that I learned that thrillers up front are about. I guess, James, you mentioned that willful like transgression, that like, oh shit moment. And then, you know, the inciting incident, that's the consequences. And then I like, as a reader, the thriller that's, you know, the psychological thriller where you're going along on this journey and you're trying to discover alongside the character, is this all in my head? Is it not? Yeah. Like, am I just like misreading things? Is there something more sinister at like play? Like, am I, you know, what? And I think sci-fi lends itself more so to that in a world where we don't know that sci-fi-ish things are actually capable of happening. Mm-hmm. And so my character wakes up in this world and she's like, body swapping is not real. And so then you advance through the plot of, but is it though?
Your publisher 100% needs to put Altered Carbon meets Freaky Friday as the comp on the book cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I hop in on the structure thing?
Yeah.
So I tend to use this structural theory called the Mice Quotient a fair bit when I'm thinking about things. And I'm going to run through it real fast because it will give me the tools to talk about the thing I'm about to talk about. So it's basically, it's an acronym, milieu, inquiry, character, and event. So milieu is about place, inquiry, the questions, characters, and events are the shifts of the status quo. And what I find with a thriller, when I was thinking about the construction of it and when I look at others, is that there is a very strong milieu element. And a milieu begins when you cross a threshold, and it ends when you cross the other threshold. And so it's all about navigating through that space, and will you be able to navigate successfully? Inquiry begins with a question, like what's happening across the way, you know, out my rear window. And it begins when you answer it ends when you answer the question. And an event begins with a shift of the status quo. And it ends when the status quo is restored or you have a new status quo. And the thing that I found when I was working on Relentless Moon, and then The Spearman is straight up murder mystery. It has some thriller elements to it, but it's not classically structured as a thriller. But the thing that I found was that if I interrupted one of those threads with another thread, so if I've got a scene where they are you know, they're trapped in a room. And in order to get out of that room, they have to do a certain thing. So that's a straight up milieu moment. But to stop them from getting out of the room, rather than having something go wrong with the room, I have a larger event happen, or I have a larger inquiry, you know, a new question arises that that interrupts that. And so you have the lingering tension from the thing that was initially going wrong. And then I've added a new different thing that is related. And so I braid those things, those three elements back and forth as I move through the story, which allows me to keep ramping the tension up without having to resort to making things completely implausible with the, yes, the level of things that are going wrong, just by never letting them quite resolve a thing.
Yeah, and I think that
definitely... a great talk to NASA Mayor Arnett, by the way. I think about talking about mice. I think it's to NASA, right?
Through NASA?
Didn't you give a talk talking about the MI milieu inquiries,
yes,
and everything,
yes,
through NASA?
Yes.
Everyone find that interview. It's online somewhere.
I'll link
amazing
to it in the description.
Yeah. That's ahead, I think we did that with the Houston We Have a Podcast. I think I may have done that there. It's my default.
But Sylvain, I'll toss it back to you, but I also want to build on what you're talking about, Mayor Robinette, because I love this mice quotient because it can apply to a broader story. It's so efficient in the way that you can apply it to different structural hierarchies within a story. It's like you can apply it to a moment or a scene, mm-hmm, or a chapter or an act or a novel as a whole. And Sylvain, I was curious, you know, you brought up this sort of epistolary nature of Sleeping Giants earlier, where you have, you know, documents and redacted documents and stuff like that. How did you approach tension and pacing from that perspective when you were using so much more dialogue and you were kind of building out the world through interactions between different people?
Yeah. Pacing is weird. And I don't usually think about things sort of consciously, like, mm-hmm, technical aspects of writing. There's a lot of seat of your pant technology involved when I do it. But in this particular case, I thought about pacing a lot. What do I do? And because it's 80,000 words of unattributed dialogue. Mm-hmm. So, and I tried to, in a bunch of places anyway, to sort of match the speed of the conversation with the speed of the events and the tension that I was trying to create. And so when people feel like they're losing control, things start going a little faster, and then you have shorter bits of dialogue and people are just, you know, saying short things at each other. It was an interesting challenge. Take Him to the Stars was also interesting because Space Race. Instead of writing an alternate history, I wrote a secret history. So I kept all the events, mm-hmm, as is with the dates. So once I picked my events, I had a pacing that was sort of like forced upon the story. And I'm like, what did he do for 2 years? Why does it take 2 years? What's happening? Why is this? And so especially for the characters, what they're going through was the pacing of that was dictated by actual events. It was super interesting to write. I like sort of giving myself weird challenges, like 80,000 words of unattributed dialogue, and Take It to the Stars, but mostly the first book, History of What Comes Next, so also sort of had its own challenge. I guess I find it stimulating, same way maybe Twitter worked, because you had to say things in under a certain number of characters. I like the constraint. I guess it helps my brain function.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I've talked about before with friends, and the fact that creative constraint actually gives you more freedom in a very paradoxical way. At least for me personally, I found this with tattooing. As a tattoo artist, before the pandemic, I had a fixed constraint of the actual biology of a human being and their skin. how their skin worked and all that kind of stuff, but also how I knew in terms of like my foreknowledge of what happens to skin over time on different parts of the body. And so stories work in a similar way, in the sense that the structure and the way that you're approaching a story, just as a creative individual, where a lot of this stuff is just coming from this obscure part in your subconscious and vomiting itself upon the page. Obviously, through revision, a lot of this stuff gets fixed up. But at the same time, it's good to have that constraint upon yourself, whether it's, you know, the way that you're approaching the idea that you have, whether it's through the structure or, you know, in Sylvain, your case, like giving yourself, you know, unattributed dialogue as your constraint, that actually makes you more creative in the way that you approach certain things. And a lot of it just comes out unconsciously onto the page. And James, I wanted to ask you as well, because Dare to Know in particular has a very interesting structure to it. There's not definitive chapters throughout most of it. And so it's kind of like this stream of consciousness type mm-hmm. vibe to it. I was curious how you approached pacing and tension from that angle.
So I didn't want to do like a hero's journey structure or like some of the structures that I already seen. But what I was interested in is that there's this kind of structure of the kind of rise and fall of societies, which like, you know, like, and this is like the idea of like, okay, we start out with like there's a world of chaos and nobody believes in anything. Then suddenly this idea comes about, this motif that everybody kind of gets behind. And this is what you would call like the age of the gods, in which everybody seems to be going under the same divine inspiration. And then that kind of degenerates. And this is a pattern that you see in societies. You see it in like the rise and fall of music scenes. You see it in friendships, even with yourself. So there's the age of gods, and then that kind of degenerates into the age of heroes or the age of aristocrats, in which like nobody is still kind of has this divine inspiration anymore, but we create these rituals and these kind of mechanisms to enforce the original vision. And that kind of degenerates into the age of man, in which democratic age, which we're kind of looking at these rituals and they seem empty to us, and we question them, and in questioning them we kind of break down the whole system and deny the original kind of originating vision, which leads us back to an age of chaos again, and then when it'll all start over again but with a different originating vision. I thought that would be an interesting way to structure a book. So there are four parts to the book, like four chapters to it, but yeah, each chapter like that gives it its general structure broadly, but each chapter has a more kind of a fever dream kind of or it gets more fever dreamish as it goes on. It starts kind of realistic and all together, but I wanted to have a different kind of structure that and then replicate that structure in almost like a fractal way, like page by page or section by section in the larger thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I also love how you framed it with the title of a Beatles song. You poke a lot of fun at the Beatles. You poke a lot of fun at the Beatles in that book, but it's good.
That song, "You Know My Name, Look Up the Number," follows that mm-hmm. exact structure. It's all together, and then it just kind of degenerates in this very interesting way. And that was originally mm-hmm. the title of the book, "You Know My Name, Look Up the Number," but they said you can't sell a book with a name like that. Dare to Know is a better name.
But I think it's really interesting that you take, you know, it's so fascinating and so poignant to think about that into the context of today's society, to think like, how close are we to the age of chaos? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like you can map out this progression in a country like the United States, for instance, the original vision, the age of heroes, and the continuation of that vision, the age of aristocrats, and then the age of democracy. It's like, at what point does it kind of devolve and revert to a chaotic state, you know?
And that's the thing. It's like, it's you thought it was devolution, but it's like each stage has its own kind of virtues and vices. So the age mm-hmm. of equality or the age of democracy, there's going to be more rights and there's going to be more science, but it's mm-hmm. like on its way, like inevitably to chaos. And like maybe there's more uniformity in the age of gods, but it's much more repressive. I don't even know if this is even true, but I when I saw the structure, I was like, oh, this is a good way to organize a story. Mm-hmm. Whether or not, I know that people have written, there's this book called The Fourth Turning, which is all about this as applied to American history. And I read it and I'm not convinced. It seems like it's like a structure and you can almost pour any kind of liquid into it and the liquid will take the shape of that structure. But for a storyteller, we love structures, regardless of whether or not they're true, because it gives us something to hang our story on.
Yeah. Oh man, so fascinating. That was really cool to sort of see that all unfold. And also, I just recently read Annalee Newitt's book. What is it?
Oh, the
Four Lost Cities.
And yeah, which is all about Cahokia, which is, exactly. Yeah, my book. Yeah. And that's a complete coincidence. Cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And Mary Robinette, I wanted to ask you, and Sylvain, because you were playing with history in this sense, I want to focus a little bit more on world building again. You both approached the space age from different angles, which I thought is really cool now that we've got you both here together. Mary Robinette, you approached it from the angle of alternate history, where after World War II, the I can't remember the name of the president, President Dewey.
Yeah, Dewey.
Yeah. So Dewey ends
Dewey
up
instead
the president.
Of Truman. Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's like Dewey instead of Truman, and then this kind of like lays the groundwork for this alternate trajectory in American history. What was your approach when it came to writing this series, The Lady Astronauts, in terms of using that alternate history as on one hand, as a way of enhancing the aspects of the storytelling and the structure, but at the same time using the storytelling and the structure to infuse those world building elements in a natural way?
So the thing that I like about alternate history is that it allows you to talk about issues with an emotional distance, and that emotional distance creates space for the reader to insert themselves. So it means is that I can just have things that happen, and I can trust that the reader will draw their own parallels, because the racism, the sexism, all of the biases of the 1950s are happening still. You know, they don't go away, and readers can draw those parallels on their own. Mm-hmm. So using that structure, and then using basically, I mean, I write about the space program because I am deeply invested and love it. But it's also a little bit of a, come here, I'm going to talk to you about rocket ships. Okay, so sexism, you know, it's not bait and switch. It's just, you know, a spoonful of sugar, spoonful of rocket fuel. Helps the medicine go up. I'm not exact. That metaphor died very quickly. But it is one of the things that I love about science fiction and fantasy, is that it takes, you know, by shifting things just a little bit, you get that that emotional distance. You get to see the connective tissue, and the readers can, you know, they can then see all of those pieces and. That gives them a better understanding of what's happening in their own world in the here and the now.
Yeah. And Sylvain, what was your approach? Because you mentioned it's like you were looking at a historical timeline and trying to figure out, like, how do I fit the pieces together within this timeline? And basically, like, digging into the shadows of what was going on in the space race at that time and making it my own, but also using history as the foundation for it.
Yeah, I had a bigger arc for this project. It sort of started, I wanted a story that could span millennia, like with a multi-generational thing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want immortals. So I ended up, in short, there's slightly homicidal self-cloning alien mothers and daughters who mess with history homicidal. From like 3,000 years ago to like today. You know, and they want us to leave this planet because we're all going to die at some point. And so the 40s was a great place. I will say, Mary Robinette, you write the 40s. I was so amazed. Like you can feel it. You can smell it. Everything, the fake shine that hides all the ugly things underneath. It's just, I was fascinated by
the,
this.
The jibes. So many jibes, man.
No, I'm always amazed at people who do great things, but I'm even more amazed when it's things that I can't do, like when people do things differently than me.
Oh yeah, no, that's always the most fun.
Whoa, yeah, yeah. Like, I'm always
80,000 words of unattributed dialogue. I'm just like, what How?
It's a project. But yeah, and the space race was interesting. It was like you know, going to the, I don't know, the Lego store and getting sort of a random bag of Lego blocks. And then you're like, okay, that's what you have to play with. And how do you make a story out of that with aliens? Mm-hmm. I had a great time. Someday I would like to do like a panel with a bunch of people who inserted Wernher von Braun into their book and compare the various degrees of assholeness we gave him.
Yeah. You're watching For All Mankind?
Yeah.
Yeah. Wernher von Braun. Like the moment he appears, I'm like, but you're making him nice. This is not okay.
And then, I know. I was really, really sort of uncomfortable with that.
Yeah.
Robert Sawyer also has him in the Oppenheimer alternative, which is about Oppenheimer. But he's a bit of an asshole, but again, not enough, I think. But yeah.
I'll get you two on a panel with the showrunner for All of Mankind. Jane, I'll toss it back to you because you're bringing up earlier. It's like you had this claustrophobic perspective on the main character. How did you approach world building from the perspective of this contextual confinement? You know what I mean?
Yeah. It had to start, I think, with my character. So I had to build him from kind of like the way back right up to where you see him on the first page. Mm-hmm. While I was writing The Merry Man, I kept on finding out, well, I need a tool. I need tools. So I built my world as I needed tools. And I kind of look at that as cheating, but
that's not cheating. Forget it.
In sci-fi, you can do that. So along with cloning, I had to develop this drug that could download somebody's thoughts and neural pathways, essentially their whole brain and personality into the body of the clone. So they'd be identical in every possible way. Mm-hmm. And so I created the drug. And for me, that was the most fun. And it was probably the most world building that I had to do because I really had to sit and think, well, there are different ways to take this drug. There are different people who are taking it. Different things happen depending on how you take it and when. And there's this real sinister element of the drug where people are taking it wrong and, you know, killing themselves. And the whole time you have these questions in your head, the person who takes it more than anything is my main character during the course of this project he signed on to. Mm-hmm. So my world building really was things like that, because otherwise it takes place in, you know, down the street or, you know, 5 minutes from now. And like I said, I really didn't have this big expansive world. The next thing I wrote, which was a novella, I wanted to kind of challenge myself. So it took place on two different planets, and that was real. That was hard for me. But with The Merry Men, it was the details that built the world. And I think that's how I made it believable, because mm-hmm. you understood how things worked. Yeah. It's kind of like magic, I guess, in a fantasy.
Yeah, definitely. And I like how you use the story to inform what your world building would be, because it all, you know, it's just enough world building. It's like, there's a certain sort of adage when it comes to writing that only put on the page what the reader needs to know.
And
they need to know it. Everything else they can intuit.
Right.
And so you did a really good job of using that environment, that claustrophobic environment, and infusing just enough detail where you can kind of intuit what's going on in the broader world and who some of the different players are and what the political and social perception of this drug are and that kind of thing. So I thought that was really cool. And I love how you ended up writing a novella that was set on two different planets, because I wanted to toss it to Nia. It's like, you know, a secondary world. This is the kind of thing where it's like you are you are using the complete imaginative fabric of this story to give the necessary tension and pacing and everything that you need. But what was your approach when it came to the world building for this story? Because Mary Robinette, you brought up politics earlier. Nia's book is full of politics, but it's really, really thrilling. So
I think I had several. So my chief approach was I didn't want to be constrained by, you know, rules or like regulations or like real history. If I said it like, you know, like on our planet in the past or even on our planet in like the near future, or even in like a portal world where like it had a link back to Earth. So I kind of was like, I'm going to cheat and get around this. And it's completely a secondary world in an entirely different galaxy where Earth is not even a thing. And that way I don't have the constraint of like having to like juggle, you know, readers reading it through a lens of what maybe or may not be possible in our world or in a future world that you know, that has evolved from our, you know, Earth's civilizations. So that was the rationale to set it like in a completely different universe in space. I also wanted to feel like have the aesthetics of fantasy, but have the technology of sci-fi. And it's kind of hard to do that when you're on Earth. So again, I was like, we're in space in a on a completely different planet, and that's why we have these, you know, kind of like clashing old world fantasy vibes with the sci-fi technology. For the political clashes, it's interesting. You said that, you know, there's this adage where you give only what the reader needs. And only what, you know, is needed right then. I definitely built up the politics of my world to deliberately give me the plot that I want, you know, to deliberately give me the conflicts, and like the societal clashes and also my main character clashes that I wanted. Like I knew I wanted her to be a Black woman struggling with racism and misogyny in a very military type world. And so then that's how she ended up living in this society that's sort of an analog to the US, that's like heavily patriarchal and heavily, you know, cis as white, because I wanted her to be able to grapple with those things. And so, you know, I could kind of like analyze, you know, in real life, you know, what do ambitious Black women, what are, you know, the everyday challenges and like struggles that they have to, you know, overcomplish. But I also wanted conflicts to, I guess, span the planet. And I wanted the feuds spanning the planet to be heavily involved from historical clashes and just kind of like grudges that have spilled over to, you know, when the novel starts. And I made the death of her grandfather that occurs off page, well, actually the murder that occurs off page before, you know, we ever start the book. I kind of pulled in, you know, leaned heavily on that mystery element to be he's like the glue that links all of these different feuding nations, whether they were his allies or, you know, staunchly against this Black man, you know, coming into this position of power. And so I use his death as kind of like the off-page inciting incident that kind of like sets the stage for a new world wave of political clashes that are going on, because now that this military power is, you know, no longer in the game, like he's off the chessboard, you know, all of the nations are kind of like maneuvering, you know, and coming up with their own machinations. How do I take advantage of this power vacuum? And then I guess the thriller aspects unintentionally got pulled in because Akena is trying to figure out who murdered her grandfather and like why, but there's bigger forces at play. Some of them are otherworldly and some of them are very much human machinations. But Akena has this ability that she knows about, but the rest of the world doesn't necessarily know about. And she's kind of like she engages in this like psychological game of cat and mouse with both herself and this magic that she's grappling with, and herself and the people around her, because there are, she makes decisions without like spoilers, like she makes decisions that then kicks off events and like danger that's circling, and she doesn't necessarily know that it's circling until, you know, the reader discovers the intrigue and like that's going on, as like akin as like, you know, this is something I'm in over my head. I never even considered that things could run like this deep.
Yeah, and that kind of ties back into what we were saying about characters, how, you know, just don't open the briefcase. Don't do that. And you wrote a character who's very brash. We talked about this back in March when we spoke, but she's, I think you referred to her as like a badass kind of ass kicking type protagonist,
yeah.
But she's also very impulsive. And I think impulsive characters tend to work really well in thrillers. Cause it's like, yeah, maybe you shouldn't do that. Oh, you did it. Okay. Let's go.
Oh, no. It's like the don't push the red button, yeah. You know, phenomenon, but like the character's like, I can deal with whatever happens, and she pushes it and she's like, oh shit, actually no.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. Maybe you shouldn't have gotten into a fight with that person, huh?
Maybe.
Awesome. And I wanted to ask you all, you know, looking at the future of science fiction and then more specifically sci-fi thrillers, what do you feel is missing or underrepresented within this space? James, I'll toss it to you first.
I can't speak to what's unrepresented in the space because I haven't read it all. You know, I bet no matter what I could think of, I'm sure all of you would tell me, oh no, there's that one novel, there's five novels that do that. So I read my fair share of science fiction, but I don't know what's underrepresented because I haven't read it all.
Mm-hmm. But do you feel like there's in terms of what you have read, what you'd like to see more of potentially?
I just want to be surprised. I want, like the other day I read like the million and first like kind of dystopia about people like walking across a blasted landscape, and it seemed like so unnecessary. It seemed like, oh God, I've read Station 11, I've read The Road, and now I'm reading this. And like, I think there are some things that are played out. I mean, like the book that the series that thrilled me the most recently was Xixin Liu's Three Body Problem books.
Yes.
And yeah. I think the reason I like those so much, and I came to them kind of late, I only read them last year, but there's like a new idea on every page that I wouldn't have thought of on my own. And it came at from such a weird angle. And there's so much stuff in there that seems like an editor, like maybe an American editor, would say, I don't know, could you get rid of this part in which like they're hanging out with Osama bin Laden, you know, or like there's a really weird or like borderline like juvenile or kind of like cringeworthy or cancelable parts of the Three Body Problem and its sequels. And but for me, like that's the great stuff. It's like when you read a Haruki Murakami novel, like he gets away with all kinds of weird sex stuff that you never could in an American novel, because like, it's foreign, it's translation, maybe it's okay in the original. So I want to be surprised, and I want to see, I guess maybe what I from my last two examples, I guess I want to see more stuff in translation and perspectives that I haven't seen before. I want to see moves. I want to see things beyond the hero's journey. I want to see I just want to be genuinely surprised, because when I was a kid and I first started getting into science fiction and I was reading like Golden Age stuff like Bradbury, Asimov, and you know, Arthur C. Clarke and all the stuff that I assume most of us cut our teeth on, I was always surprised. And then over time, like in my 20s, I kind of drifted away from science fiction because it seemed like I kept reading things that just seemed to be, I was reading the wrong things probably, but just had ossified into certain patterns that weren't attractive to me anymore. And then I'm finding stuff that I like, but it's maybe only every third book. That Xixin Liu series like really blew me away. And then I realized like he's written 50 other books or something. I was like, I can't read all of them. That would be just a lifestyle choice. But I really enjoyed the stuff that I read. So yeah, like more stuff that has big ideas that I haven't seen before. Because I think that's what science fiction is good for. Big ideas. Not just taking, you know, say a thriller and just putting it in space, you know, or like just taking, not having science fiction be the trappings which we hang onto a structure, but having the ideas really push the story into places that I have never seen before. That's what I want.
Yeah, it's kind of like a progression of the golden age. It's like bring the big ideas, meld them with the more modern character focus kind of stuff. Just bring those two things together.
I hate character. I hate character.
Oh, get out of here, James. Get out of here.
No, but like, She Should Lose books. I mean, the great thing about those books is that he doesn't give a shit about character. Like, the characters are all paper thin, in my opinion.
No. I can't agree with you on that. I think that one of the things that is happening with those characters is that they are not being written for us, that they are being written for a Chinese audience. And I think that a lot of the character moments in there are things that just don't read for us, because there are definitely like the you remember the camera scene where he sees the numbers, like that was the moment where I felt most connected to the character, and I realized, oh, this is the one point up to that point where I have a common experience and where we've got common context, and so I think that tells me and then reading and talking to other people, I'm fairly confident that it's just lacking a common context on that.
But we got
characters that are cultural subtext.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's a lot that I'm missing, but it did put me in the mind of reading an Arthur C. Clarke thing or an Isaac Asimov thing in which the ideas were foremost, and like you weren't spending. Insofar as we did get into a character, it's like that wall facer guy who just spent like about 100 pages constructing the perfect woman. And it's just like, good Lord, to talk about problematic. But again, I guess there's a lot that went over my head. But I don't know. There's like that cop guy with a heart of gold. You know, I don't know. I've seen that character a million times before. I guess there's a lot of stuff, especially in the original, you know, language that I'm sure that I'm missing. But my experience, you know, is that, oh, these characters feel refreshingly thin in the way that your Arthur C. Clarke characters are refreshingly thin, because you want to know what's happening inside Rama. You don't really care about the people who are exploring Rama.
True. So I'm going to go next, because by contrast, what I want to see more of is character. And specifically, I'm thinking of Murderbot. Like, the Murderbot Diaries are straight up thriller, and they are also these beautiful character portraits.
So sarcastic.
I love them. I want more things that are character studies while also being thriller. I want more things that are humorous while being thriller. And I want more things, and this is, again, I want more things where science is not the problem, but actually the solution, because they exist, but they are not as common. And I want to see more of them.
Yeah, I agree with that wholeheartedly. Martha Wells is an amazing writer, and Murderbot is like, that's my comfort read. I've got them right up there. If I have like a big chonky book, I just pop into one of those novellas and have a great time for a day.
Speaking of the books that are behind you, looking at Sylvain's bookshelf is a real roller coaster ride, because I see behind him Sally Rooney, but then I see Cassandra Clare. Then I see that hybrid novel S that J.J. Abrams thing. But then I also see Twilight right next to it. You've got a crazy bookshelf, man.
He told us earlier. It was expected. Well, Sylvain, what do you feel like is missing or underrepresented in sci-fi thrillers that you'd like to see more of?
Yeah, missing probably nothing. I mean, I'm sure the books are out there with whatever. We need more representation of all kinds in advertising budgets, I think, and translation. Translation, I think, is key. At least it's one of the things I'm interested in. I like what I'm missing is different ways of telling stories. And one of the things I get some like focused on these days for whatever reason is agency. We read like agency is a big thing here. We need agency. We write heroes. They do stuff. They, you know, what? And I tried to play with it, like, you know, rob the characters of their agency as much as I could, but it's difficult. And I still do it in a way that I'm sure is influenced by everything that I've read. So to I like things to approach this like from a totally different perspective. I'm interested in not so much what people do or even plot, but how people sort of go through it and what they experience. So anyway, and Netflix is sort of doing that in some level, on some level with TV. They have this, all these programs like in different countries where basically they're looking mm-hmm. for a local show for a global audience. But we get to see, you know, Korean TV and things we normally wouldn't have seen. And I think in that sense, that's sort of good. But yeah, I want people to mess with what I think is normal in a story.
Yeah. And that kind of plays into what James was saying. It's like, I like how different countries have different ideas of story structure and expectations and that kind of thing. And like Mary Robinette and James were talking about, it's like there is a cultural subtext to Chinese literature because Chinese culture conversation has more subtext to it. Whereas North Americans are very like, tell me everything as clearly as possible. And that's kind of how the story structures have developed. And they've kind of come into this more rigid expectation, which is why I'm glad, James, you approached Dare to Know from that angle of like 3-act structure or 5-act structure and things like that. It's like, just fuck it, fuck with it a little bit, like mess with the system and, you know, surprise people. Like, I think that can be another way where surprise comes into play, is like the way that people approach the means of storytelling. And if that comes through translation, that's like an amazing avenue for people to get introduced to that kind of thing.
I like it when a writer risks dissatisfaction.
Yes.
Or courts it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think courting is a better idea because it's playful. A book is playful.
Yeah.
Nia, what about you? What do you feel like is missing or underrepresented?
On a broad sense, I know they're out there, but I'd like to see more POC and marginalized characters in thriller always. On a more specific sense, I read Bethany C. Morrow's Cherish Fair earlier this year. It was phenomenal, and I would really like to see more books that kind of play with the line between, is something paranormal or otherworldly happening, or is it not? Is our protagonist the actual sinister thing, you know, about this novel, or, you know, is it outside forces? And Cherish Fair is when it, like, I just flew through the pages trying to answer those questions. Like, is she some, like, without, you know, is something paranormal happening, or is there, you know, a real life social horror explanation for it? Basically, like, what the hell is going on with the characters and this world was, you know, my question from beginning to end. And I enjoyed it. And I like to see more books that play with, you know, those questions of, is it otherworldly or is it not? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
I like that. Just messing with reality a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And Jane, what about you?
I almost forget the question because I was so involved in the in the conversation. But something, I think it was something about talking about books in translation. I mean, first of all, that's how I got into science fiction when I was much younger to begin with. I was in a used bookstore in Cambridge and I came across a book by Stanislaw Lem, who I had never heard of at that point. And I literally bought it because I loved his name. I'm like, that's the coolest name I've ever heard. And kind of like you, Sylvain. but anyway, that kind of got me thinking in my own mind. I loved whoever said different ways to tell a story. There are different ways to tell it. And part of that's happening right now. It's this crazy little silly thing on Twitter. I don't know if any of you guys have been following it, called Salts. Is the name of the story, and it's done in these tiny little video vignettes over Twitter. So they're very short, but it's all done not by a writer, but by a tech guy who is using AI. And wow. He will describe the visual that he wants and describe the voice that he wants. And it's all, and then as he puts these up on Twitter, he asks his followers to kind of vote on what's going to happen next. which is kind of another layer of artificial intelligence, if you think about it, because it's the mind, you know, the hive mind. So it's like all these things kind of piled onto each other. And I'm not saying the story is great, but it is so interesting.
I was waiting for that shoe to drop.
Well, there's all kinds of tangents coming in, but a couple of them are really captivating. Yeah. A couple of them are, wait, what is that? Don't put that in your mouth. Or, you know, it's very interesting just to see the way that a story can be told. And so I'm following it. I think it's really not the story or the plot or the any of that, but I'm just fascinated that it's being done.
Yeah, it's like the novelty of it. And that's the most science fiction very much thing ever.
The medium is the message moment.
Exactly. Yeah,
get like
which is very cool.
McLuhan in here. Yeah. Very cool. What is that called again?
Salt. Like salt. Table salt. You know? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I need to check this out. Yeah,
definitely check it out. Oof. It's worth checking out if, you know, just to read about how he does it.
Mm-hmm.
Really interesting. Amazing.
Cool. And just to sort of wind things down, I wanted to ask each of you if you could offer up a piece of advice to new authors or authors who are currently writing and have already published books, but are kind of in this sci-fi thriller space, and any advice you have for them in terms of, you know, approaching their work or whatever pops into your head. Sylvain, I'll start with you.
All right. I get asked a lot for some reason, especially up here. And my first advice is don't listen to advice. Like, there are no rules, forget it, whatever. But the only real advice is for people who want to get published is write a book that you're so happy with that even if you show it to 10 people and they tell you it's complete trash, you're still going to open it and look at it with a smile.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, then you're in trouble because people are going to like mess with your self-worth and your insides are going to get all torn up. And and so you write something that you couldn't care less if no one else likes it. You think it's good and no one will change that opinion because it's the only thing you have control over. The rest of it is totally out of your hands. Other than that, don't listen to people. Just
yeah. Forget everything that everyone else is about to say. Nia, go for it.
No, I definitely agree. I think there's so much prevailing advice that says don't blend genres or encourages new writers to like kind of like shy away. And I'm like, listen, if it's what you want to do, like if you have two loves or two, you know, passions, like definitely like, or three or five, I'm like, definitely like Sylvain was saying, go for it and write the book that you love and that you want to read and that you'll be, you know, happy about regardless, because there's always a reader for it and there's always, you know, space for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely agree. Jane?
I love that advice. You know, you definitely have to be happy with it. But for me, I think what worked is remembering through the whole process, remembering what it was that got me interested enough to start the project in the first place. And for me, that's usually a question that I was just fascinated with. And for me, it was what would happen if you could watch your own clone? Mm-hmm. And thinking about all the different ramifications of that. So through the writing and through the editing and through the endless revisions and through, you know, all the trials and tribulations of trying to get from, you know, to get published, I kept that little kernel of wonder, you know, true to the story. And as long as that didn't change, I was okay. But, and that's another way of saying you have to be happy with the story you wrote.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to be happy with it in every single moment.
No. But, oh, and you never are.
But an end product that you can be like, yeah, I'm very satisfied. But I love that, Jane. It's like you're constantly rekindling this idea. It's like, why did I decide to start this in the first place? And grasp onto that and let it just kind of sink into your brain and come back to it anytime you're working on a chapter or like revising or something and thinking like, oh, fuck, this is trash and just want to throw this out. And you think, okay, yeah, I got to go back to this idea that kept me here in the first place. Yeah. James, what about you?
Writing advice? Well, I have a podcast called The Secrets of Story that I do with Matt Bird, the guy who gave that advice or that description earlier about thrillers. Mm-hmm. And however, like, he's much more about all these rules and advice, and I'm much more intuitive and practical. And you can, and that kind of is borne out by the fact that he's written two books of writing advice, but no novels. And so I'm kind of like the right brain and he's the left brain or the other way around. I never remember which brain is which brain. But I will say if there is something that, to get somebody out of, they're kind of have run aground, in their writing and they don't know what to do next, I would say this is something that you can kind of lose sight of as you're writing your book. Make sure that your protagonist always has a goal that's physically realizable. That, like, not that, like, oh, I wish I was a better person, but like, I have to go rescue the Princess Leia. You know, like there's a physical thing that you know when you've done, you see that it's been done. And even in the most abstract story, I think there should be, like, moment by moment, you should know what your character physically wants. And, or like in Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's not like, I want to be a better archaeologist. Like, I want the Ark of the Covenant. And then have, and if it's the main goal, have that goal not be achieved at the end of it, but at the middle. Like, Luke gets Princess Leia in the middle of Star Wars. Indiana Jones gets the Ark of the Covenant in the middle of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And then all kinds of shit happens that's fallout of getting this physically realizable goal. And, like, that's where the story really gets good. So have there be a goal and have them get it midway through and not at the end.
Cool. Yeah, I like that. And I will definitely link to your podcast in the description as well. Go for it, Neil.
Love it. And I would add, if it's a series or, you know, multiple books, then I guess the end would make sense because then they have the goal. But now book two, we're dealing with the shit ton of fallout from the goal. But I really like the way that is framed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Mary Robinette, you really missed me. I was really brilliant for a second.
Oh, my goodness.
And you missed it.
Did you tell me the secret to publishing?
Yeah. Too bad. Oh, you missed it.
Well, speaking of writing advice, what excuse does Mary Robinette have? No, I'm just kidding. I hope everything's okay with your mother. But we were just talking about writing advice. If you have some advice, general or specific to sci-fi thrillers, for any authors out there listening.
Basically, you should do what all of the other panelists have already told you. They're brilliant. you know, that's really my advice. The thing that I would say is that all of the stuff that we're talking about can be very technical. And when you're writing, it's very easy to focus on the technique, but don't forget that at the end of the day, or the beginning of the day, really, the person that you're writing for is yourself, and that you need to chase your own emotions. And if the emotion that you're chasing doesn't fit into one of these models or modes that we've talked about, that doesn't mean that it's wrong. It just means that you're using a different recipe, and that's fine. You can always use the tools that we've talked about as a diagnostic later if something isn't hitting the way you want it to hit. But first and foremost, write something that makes you happy.
Yeah, love that. Because everything we've said throughout this entire episode is prescriptive, so don't take it.
I was going to say it's a really good point, though. I've never heard good writing advice, but I've heard amazing writing advice when it comes time to fixing something.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because every writer needs that. They need to fix something, whether it's themselves or their story.
Right. So, like, when you're first vomiting out, you don't want to be thinking about rules. Everybody just has this weird, like, Lovecraftian kind of mouth on their body. It's some kind of body horror thing. And it's just like gabbling back. And it's just, most of it is garbage. Just get it all on the page. And then once that garbage is on the page from this demonic mouth, then you shut the mouth off and then or shut it down or make the volume. And then you use your more analytical brain and all the rules that you've learned and all the advice that you've gotten to kind of make it make sense or make it better. But if you are thinking in a rules-based way while you're writing it down at first, you are dead.
But it's like most things, like you buy, I don't know, like a guitar amp and you just use it the way you want to use it. And suddenly something doesn't work. And then you need to go on YouTube and find some technical explanation for it.
Yeah. My friend Patricia Jackson, she calls it unicorn vomit. Which I love because it's absolute just like you say, Lovecraftian spew, but there is magic in there somewhere. And then afterwards you have to go in and refine that unicorn vomit. And so it sparkles more and more each time.
Yeah. But by contrast, I'm always the contrarian, apparently. I will often write very consciously, but as an exercise, so that I can internalize those techniques so that when I get to the word vomit phase, that I'm at least vomiting with some structure that I have internalized.
It's structural.
Vomiting with
it's
structure.
Structured vomit. Vomiting with like structural vomit. We've been dealing a lot with a very, very sick cat. So I've been dealing, it's like, how structural is his poo? And you do want structural poo.
You do.
I do something similar, except instead of writing structurally, I will read like a work I really love. Yeah. And like, so like, I will like sit down before a session and read like a first chapter, just so I'm my brain is soaking up the master class that the book is. And then I can word vomit with some type of brilliance.
Deconstruct for inspiration. I like
that. Did anybody else do this when they were a kid? Like, I would just copy out books that I liked.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Copying the masters. It's a, when I was writing my my Jane Austen books, I would read a chapter of Jane Austen and then write a chapter. But I would also some days copy out a scene or a page as a warm up, just to get that voice into my fingers.
Nice. Yeah, the physical action of writing it, really, there's something to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, amazing. Well, I appreciate all of this. That was a very fun writing advice segment, because sometimes it's like very serious, but this devolved into vomit and all kinds of madness, but I really appreciate it. Just to finish off, if each of you could recommend a book that you recommend, a book that you think really encapsulates this idea of thriller, whether it's science fiction or not, just a book that you really love and want to share with everybody. So Jane, I'll start with you.
I've been thinking about that during this whole thing. There's so many that I've read. But the one that jumps out to me, and I think it's because there's been so much talk about structure, and that's really interesting to me, is Claire Holdroyd wrote a book called The Effort. And it is, an impending asteroid hit on Earth. But the way that it's structured, it's like a ticking time bomb, which is exactly the metaphor you want. And that book has, it's multi-characters, multi-locations, but it's all coming back to one, obviously, gripping story. And so that I think that's probably the one that I would recommend. And I wish I had a copy of it here, but I didn't know that question was coming. So
it's all good. Surprises. It's all about surprises. Sylvain, what about you?
Gonna go with Faith by Joma West. It just came out. It plays on what you expect from a story, and it just messes with you in the most efficient way. I've never felt more like a puppet in the hands of a writer than I did reading that book. It's amazing. I think it, just for the experience, it's just obviously not necessarily what you expect. So,
fantastic. And Nia, what about you?
I'm going to go with an author versus an actual book, because anything she writes is just amazing structurally. But anything by Tiffany D. Jackson, she is like a structural queen when it comes to plotting out thrillers and horrors and horror with thriller elements. I think the book that just came out is The Weight of Blood, which is on my shelf and is going to be like my October read. But definitely, like, she is like just a master at thriller twists and turns.
Awesome. And James?
The sci-fi thriller I read most recently was Recursion by Blake Crouch, and I thought that was really good. I think that's probably his best book.
You stole mine, man. It's fantastic, though. For me, it's just like a masterclass in effective language and relentless pacing. It's just like, if you want to burn through a book in like 2 days and have your mind just... Blake Crouch is a good person to go with. So.
He there's character in it, but he doesn't let it bog down in character.
Exactly.
Refreshingly, it's not bad to have characters who aren't fully fleshed out three-dimensional story. You need something that's functional for the story.
To me, Crouch is the quintessential plot writer. Like I'd go halfway through Dark Matter and I'd be like, how the hell is he going to get out of there? There's no way. Like,
yeah, I love that feeling. I love that. Yeah, he does it so well.
And Mary Robinette, close us out.
Hollow City by Dan Wells. The main character has paranoid schizophrenia. And the question is, what happens if the monsters he's seeing are real?
Ooh.
It's really good. It hits all of the thriller elements and also does this major, like, your mind is not the same when you finish the book.
Oh, I love that though. It's like so many writers just wrenching my brain in different directions.
Yeah.
It's good. Like Sylvain, you're talking about, it's like, I'm just a puppet, but I'm a blissfully happy, ignorant puppet. But, all of you, thank you so much. Mary Robinette, Sylvain, Nia, James, and Jane. Thank you for taking the time to talk sci-fi thrillers with me today. If you could please let viewers and listeners know where they can find you on social media, we'll go through. Nia, you go first.
Twitter, which I'm on way too much, Nia_Davenport. Instagram is Nia.Davenport. My website is nedavenport.com.
Cool. And your book is The Blood Trials.
Yes.
Yeah. And Sylvain, what about you?
Last name, NEUVEL.net is the website. Without the .net, we'll get you the right spot on social media. I have an Audible exclusive that just came out about a mysterious signal from outer space called No Kindness Too Soon. Check it out.
Very cool. And Jane?
I don't even know my Twitter address. I think it's something like @JaneGilMartin3. I don't know. But I do.
Well,
you can find me. It's kind of just my name. And I do have a website, janegilmartin.com.
And your book is The Mirror Man.
Yes, it is.
Cool.
And I'm James? Hopefully working on a sequel.
Nice. Very cool.
So you can find me at jameskennedy.com on Twitter at I am James Kennedy, like IAM, and then on Instagram as the only James Kennedy. Also I do a film festival called the 92nd Newbery Film Festival, in which kids make short movies that tell the entire stories of Newbery winning books in about 90 seconds, usually with a twist like Charlotte's Web in the style of like a horror movie, or a Tale of Despero, but it's done in the style of Les Miserables. And you can find all those at 92ndNewbery.com. 90Newbery, that's 1ry, .com.
Cool, and I'll link to that as well. We got lots of links in this episode because all of you are doing such cool stuff. Mary Robinette, where can people find you on social media?
So on Twitter, it's Mary Robinette. On all of the socials, there's a link tree that will lead you to all of the others. But basically, look for me with the Mary Robinette or Mary Robinette Cole on TikTok, Instagram, my own website, MaryRobinetteCole.com. On book tour and in city near you for The Spare Man.
And writing excuses on...
Oh, and writing excuses.
Every platform.
Right. Oh, that.
Oh, that thing.
WritingExcuses.com if you would like a podcast 15 minutes long because you're in a hurry and we're not that smart.
All right. And perfect note to end on. Thank you all so, so much. I really appreciate it. There we have it. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed our panel on modern sci-fi thrillers. Thank you again to our guests this episode, Mary Robinette, Sylvain, Nia, James, and Jane. If you like this episode, please subscribe, rate and review us on your favorite podcast app, and share us with your friends. It helps a lot and we greatly appreciate it. As well, don't forget to subscribe to the FanFiatic YouTube channel, where this and every other episode of the show is available in full video. SFF Addicts is part of FanFiAddict.com, so make sure to check us out there for the latest in book reviews, essays, and all things sci-fi and fantasy, as well as the full episode archive for the podcast. All music comes courtesy of the talented Astronauts. Check them out on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/STRONOZ.
All links for the episode are also available in the show notes. Now, keep reading, keep imagining, and we'll see you next time on SFF Addicts.